The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, Daniel Strain, an online news writer for Science, is here to fill us in on some recent stories on our daily news site. Well, first, Daniel, a sobering situation for harp seals.
Yeah, we have a study that looks at basically the pickiness of harp seals when it comes to ice. These are seals living on the Gulf of St. Lawrence Seaway in Canada, where the water gets very cold, and in the winter you get thick slabs of ice building up.
And you say they're picky about the particular ice that they use?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing to maybe understand is exactly how much these seals depend on ice. In January, this ice starts to build up as the waters freeze. The seals breed from around February to March, and then the ice breaks up again in April. So they have a very short time window with which to access ice on the water. And that can be important. Their pups obviously don't know how to swim yet right after they're born, so anyone that breaks through or falls into the water is in bad shape. So seals really do depend on this sea ice. And according to this new study, they depend on a very certain type of sea ice.
And what are the characteristics of that ice?
Well, according to the study, seals, and it seems sort of intuitive, but seals actually prefer very thick ice. They actually know how to recognize and actually prefer giving birth and raising their young on these very thick slabs of sea ice, including very, very new sea ice that has just started to build up.
And now climate change is threatening this?
Yeah, so what the authors actually did is they went back to the 1970s and they looked at seal behavior where these seals were giving birth to their young. They also looked at the effects of climate, sea level change, and that sort of thing. And the big implication, obviously, for this is that with warming weather, we're going to get, on the whole, a lot more bad ice conditions. So that means that a lot of these choice spots, these really thick patches of sea ice, are going to start to diminish. It's interesting to note that it gets a little bit more complicated than that, because even in bad years for sea ice as a whole in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, there can be some good patches of very thick ice. And the reverse is true. When sea ice is great, there can be some very poor patches. But it looks like what's very important is that we maintain these thick patches of ice for these seals.
And that doesn't look likely to happen as the climate continues to warm.
It certainly looks dismal for these seal nurseries, yeah.
And next, something on a somewhat lighter note, a new study about why sharks can swim so fast.
Exactly, yeah. Going from seals to the animals that eat them. This is a study that actually looks at sort of the iconically swimming sharks. Sharks are sort of famous swimmers in that they need to keep going all the time. If they stop swimming for any moment of time, they'll actually sink to the bottom. And obviously, as predators, many sharks need to be able to swim very quickly in order to catch prey. So that puts a lot of pressure on their tails, which, as this study shows, are actually pretty magnificent as far as fish tails go.
Well, they are very distinctive tails. How does that actually work to make them fast swimmers?
And that's actually a very interesting topic. If you look at a shark's tail, you can tell that the top is kind of elongated in regards to the bottom, and that actually gives them lift to keep them from actually sinking to the bottom of the ocean, unlike many other fish whose tails, if you look at goldfish, have very symmetrical tails.
But I guess now someone's looked at this a bit more quantitatively. How do you study a problem like this?
Well, they went through quite a work to do it. The first aspect is they actually looked at real-life dogfish, two species of dogfish, which would be a relatively small shark. They suspended actually small particles, so think of maybe sugar in your coffee or something like that, in water. And as the sharks beat their tails, they studied how those particles move. They bounce lasers off the particles, then use three cameras to get a 3D view of the shark's tail beating. And what researchers already knew was with every beat of the tail, you'd get these sort of vortices, these jets of waters that would spin off like a smoke ring is how they describe it. Unlike smoke rings, however, they're very forceful and they give a lot of push for these sharks. So it's these jets that are giving them their speed.
Well, that all seems rather logical. Was there anything really new in this?
Well, they actually found out that when the sharks beat their tails, you get a final sort of vortex that follows, you know, sort of with each swish, you get a big jet of water. And they're expecting to see that. What they weren't expecting to see is actually another sort of vortex that came in the middle of the tail beat. So what these sharks are doing is they're basically stiffening their tails about mid-beat. That creates a first sort of jet of water that then melds in with the second. And it seems like this may be a way to give them sort of a steady sort of push forward. And fascinatingly enough, they actually back this data up with a robotic version of a shark tail.
So a lot more going on than just beating from side to side.
Yeah, it's very fascinating news for shark enthusiasts, not great news
For their prey.
Yeah, exactly, for those skinny dipping at night, yeah.
And finally, another chapter in the long research saga about when dogs were first domesticated.
And it actually is a very long research saga. Everyone pretty much knows that dogs have come from wolves, that they're domesticated wolves, but no one is quite sure when or where actually dogs first emerged on Earth. And there's actually been two competing studies that have had very, very different findings. The first one looked at the DNA from many dogs and many wolves, actually finding that the greatest genetic diversity of dogs was centered around China, and this is actually south of the Yangtze River. And, you know, the theory is that in these locations where you have the most genetic diversity, that also coincides where a particular species sort of began, where it had its origins.
And what's the other competing hypothesis then?
The other competing hypothesis actually puts dogs' origins somewhere in the Middle East. And this study was using sort of different array of genes. So they came to very different conclusions. Now we have a new study which seems to support the China hypothesis.
And I guess this new study is coming from the same people who originally formed the China hypothesis. What are they saying here that's new?
That's right. Yeah, they're actually looking at a different kind of DNA. What they're tackling this time are genes that are held on the Y chromosome, so the male chromosome, from about 350 dogs in Asia and then more than 1,500 dogs elsewhere around the world. Again, what they found was that this really great genetic diversity, basically, south of the Yangtze River.
So, two separate lines of evidence. Case closed, right?
You wish it would be, but I guess like the whole, are you a cat person or a dog person? This is going to go on for a while. Some researchers seem to be very supportive of this finding. Other ones don't quite think that it's the final word. And there's sort of two reasons for that. One of the reasons is that genes on the Y chromosome actually represent a very small number of the genes that are in the entire dog's genetic code. So people would like future researchers to look at sort of a greater array to see if the results hold up. The other consideration is that the whole theory of where genetic diversity is highest is where the species started might not actually come into play. You can imagine that in a region like, say, the Middle East, you could have had an originally very wide diversity of dogs, but then some breeds actually wound up dying off. So what actually looks like a greater genetic diversity now is actually just sort of a red herring.
Okay, Daniel, what else are you looking at for the news site?
On Science Now, we have a story looking at new data supporting the ancient human migration out of Africa. We also have an interesting look at how urban birds and rural birds are actually starting to split genetically. And on our policy blog, Science Insider, we have a new summary of a multi-year budget proposal for the European Union science spending. This week on Science Live, our weekly online live chat, we have a look at the mysteries of the cell with experts including Science's very own editor-in-chief, Bruce Alberts. So be sure to check out these stories and more on our website.
Daniel Strain is an online news writer for Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.